Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Labor Department said today that nearly 3 million people filed for unemployment last week, bringing that total number to nearly 37 million over the last 8 weeks.
37 million, and it's more evidence of the economic devastation being caused by the coronavirus pandemic, which has already killed more than 85,000 Americans. It puts more pressure on lawmakers in Washington who are considering more economic aid for states, localities, companies, and workers. Joining us now is Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And you're on President Trump's coronavirus economic task force, advising the president on reopening the economy after the shutdowns. How are you approaching the balance of public health concerns with economic concerns? And when you see today's unemployment claims report, do you think the cure is getting to be worse than the disease?
It's very difficult right now. And what's been interesting is a lot of people that are in quote-unquote non-essential businesses that have been shelved during this time period will tell you it's not non-essential to them and to their family and to the people that work there. It is their livelihood. And so it's a very difficult balance that you continue to be able to protect the people that are most vulnerable, but you've got to be able to re-engage business. And we're not only seeing that here in the United States, with over half of the states already open and thriving and the other half looking quickly now at what their next when they're going to start that reopening, but Spain, Italy, Germany, South Korea, many countries that have been very hard hit by COVID-19, they're also in the process of reopening.
Well, when you say that more than half of the country is open and thriving, what are you thinking about when you say that? Because I don't think you could describe any place right now in the United States as open and thriving.
Other than grocery stores thriving, no, there's not a place that's really thriving as they were if you went back just 3 months ago. But their restaurants are starting to be able to open for a limited sit-down. They're starting to allow some events again. But you're correct, there's nowhere that's thriving at this point. But they're open in cleaning and preparing to try to get things back open again after a very long, difficult season.
What about the people who are laid off or furloughed or working in situations where they're not going to make the kind of money that they were able to make before? Do you think it's the government's responsibility right now to bridge the gap, to keep money coming into people's pockets if they're in that situation until things can open back up and they can get their jobs back?
Really, there's three different layers of assistance and safety net for us as a country. The families are the first safety net. The second safety net are our not-for-profits around the country. And the third safety net is the government. All of those are trying to be able to provide some assistance to help people get through this. The difficulty is none of those are going to be able to make people whole. For individuals that have lost wages, for businesses that are teetering on the edge of going out of business, there's no way to be able to borrow enough on the world currencies and to be able to try to find a way to be able to make every business and every place whole. But we can do what we can to help people be able to get through it. And so the safety net that's out there right now with the $1,200 that's been sent to individuals, the Paycheck Protection Program, which is right now helping about 50 million people get their existing paycheck, the additional money that's been put into unemployment assistance so we can get through the end of July, all of those things are designed to be able to help people get through this. But we're very aware most people will not be made whole during this time period, but we're trying to be able to help people survive it, get to the other side of it, to be able to get our economy restarted again.
Well, and what about the next possible package? And Democrats want to spend another $3 trillion, including aid to state and local governments, which have not gotten a lot of aid yet in the previous packages.
Well, actually, state and local governments have received $150 billion so far. In a state like mine in Oklahoma, our average or our typical budget for the year for the state is about $12 billion, and the state received $1.5 billion for assistance during the COVID-19. So that's a very significant amount. Now, there does need to be additional flexibility for those dollars that have been given to the state. And I'm aware that the House has proposed a package with almost $1 trillion in additional assistance to states. But I would only say to you, states and local counties and cities will be in the same struggle as the federal government, that we're all trying to be able to manage the tax dollars that are out there and services that are there. All of us are struggling as we go through this, whether it's an individual family, whether it's a small business, large business, city, county, state, or federal government as well.
So it sounds like you're saying that you think the states have enough help already, that they don't need more assistance from the federal government.
I can't imagine any state or any city or county saying they wouldn't like more help from the federal government. The balance that we have is every layer of government has to be able to figure out what they can do at this point. So there will, I'm sure, be things that will happen in the future to try to help cities and states try to be able to get through this in very specific ways, but certainly not a $3 trillion package or $1 trillion of that going to cities and counties and states with unlimited ways that they can be able to spend that.
Senator, let me just finally ask you one more thing, and I could really ask this of anybody that I talk to, but this has upended all of our lives. Is there anything, when we go back to normal, eventually it'll happen, is there anything that you'll miss about the current situation?
I do have to tell you, I have actually spent more time at home with my family during the last time period than I have in years and years. I am grateful. I love my family, and getting a chance to be able to spend time with my family has been the hidden gift in the middle of all of this chaos. I'm very looking forward to a vaccine being on the market, having the capability to be able to look in the rearview mirror on a COVID-19 outbreak. But I will always treasure times that I could spend every single evening having dinner with my family and getting more time with them.
That is Senator James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's go to China now and the city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus outbreak was first discovered. Testing for the virus there has resumed, and this time authorities want to test every person in the city. That's 11 million people, with the goal of stopping the disease from making a comeback. NPR's Emily Feng joins us now from Beijing. And Emily, explain the timing of this move to test everyone in Wuhan.
They're doing this testing move now because they've discovered 6 new cases. And this comes after more than a month where they reported no new cases whatsoever. I should note that these 6 new cases come from one cluster and one residential compound, all starting with an elderly man who says he actually felt sick 2 months ago. His symptoms were on and off, and he never got tested until now. So this is not so much a resurgence, but a lack of testing that led this cluster to emerge, which is why they've decided to go to the other extreme and test everyone in case they're asymptomatic carriers, meaning they show no symptoms whatsoever. Some state scientists have come out and said this is actually overkill. You should focus on key groups instead of testing everyone. But yeah, one of the reasons why they might be reacting so drastically is next week, big political meetings are supposed to begin in Beijing. These were delayed because of COVID-19, but they've now been rescheduled, and authorities are really fearful they might see more new cases in the run-up to these meetings.
I read that they want to get this all done in 10 days. 11 million people in 10 days, that really sounds ambitious. How are they going to make sure that everyone shows up to get tested?
In every Chinese city, including Wuhan, you have something called the Neighborhood Committee, and every residential compound has essentially these local officials who normally oversee things like domestic disputes and waste disposal, but in extraordinary times like this, oversee things like quarantining, contact tracing, and testing. The other thing is Wuhan does not have the capacity to test all 11 million people who live there within 10 days. They can test about 100,000 people a day. They will not be able to finish the entire city in 10 days.
Emily, you wrote about a new book coming out called Wuhan Diary. It's now being translated in English. What can you tell us about it?
It's written by this woman named Feng Feng, who was actually quite a well-known novelist already before she started posting these daily updates about what it was like to live life under lockdown in China. And these entries were very raw. They were reactions to the news that she heard from the day, reactions to conversations and phone calls she had had with doctors on the front lines, friends who had had family members pass away. And she often was referencing news items or videos that were very quickly censored within China. So it became a way to access what people felt like was a more accurate portrayal of what was happening in Wuhan without the state narrative imposed on top. These posts themselves began to be censored as well. And loyal fans would screenshot these entries as Feng Feng posted them online. You would get forwarded quotes from them on social media. You would see pictures of them before they could be taken down. So it became this very interactive sounding board for people as well to talk about their own experiences. Now a translator, Michael Berry, has taken all of those, collected all 60 entries and translated them into English so that we can also experience what Feng Feng went through during the Wuhan lockdown.
You know, the U.S. government has criticized China for a lack of transparency about the outbreak. What is the Chinese government's reaction to this new book coming out in English?
There hasn't been so much a government backlash against this book, but there's been this groundswell of online backlash. There's a suspicion about whether that backlash is organic or whether it's somehow state-sponsored. But what is apparent is that Feng Feng, the writer behind Wuhan Diary, has been subject to an enormous amount of hate mail, death threats, and criticism that she is somehow airing China's dirty laundry about how it handled the coronavirus and shortcomings it may have had to an international audience. She's been accused of betraying China, of somehow aiding and abetting Western governments and criticizing China. And so she's really become the symbol of growing nationalism within China and an inability to tolerate moderate or liberal voices.
That's NPR's Emily Fang speaking with us from Beijing. Emily, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
The UN is urging leaders to address mental health as the pandemic is adding to psychological distress around the world. This comes after a recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation found more than 4 in 10 Americans say stress from the pandemic has negatively impacted their mental health. Joining us now is Ken Duckworth, who serves as the Chief Medical Officer of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Dr. Duckworth, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, there was already a mental health crisis in this country before the coronavirus upended everything we know. What would you say is the state of our collective mental health right now?
Well, it really depends per individual. But, you know, we had a record number of suicides in 2018. And between overdose deaths and suicide, the American lifespan had actually been getting shorter in the last several years. So that gives you the pre-picture. Now you take on the added stress of what we call physical distancing, because you have to stay socially connected. Physical distancing, the threat of unemployment, and just the all-around anxiety that you or someone you love will get sick. And I think many people, you know, are experiencing, you know, more mental health concerns than ever before.
Obviously, this has made things more difficult for people who were already living with a mental health condition. But are you seeing a lot of people who didn't show any signs of depression or anxiety beforehand now saying, this is a real problem for me?
Yeah, is like a bell curve. Imagine, you know, the 20% of Americans who live with a mental health condition, and the bell curve has gotten pushed to the right. So more people are having anxiety, panic that didn't have it before. More people are having agoraphobia. When you're reinforced to stay at home, you can get scared to leave your home. And more people are reporting depression. So, you know, addiction is another vulnerability. We don't really have data on that yet, but AA, NA, Smart Recovery, and all kinds of services are available online. But that's an additional risk for people who've been living in recovery from a substance use disorder. So I think people are feeling the stress, but perhaps one silver lining, Jeremy, I think people who haven't had a mental health condition before may have increased empathy and sensitivity for what it's like to live with a mental health condition going forward. And I have heard that comment from more than one person. I know what this is like now in a way that I didn't before, because I'm now having panic attacks.
Is the economic picture as devastating as the anxiety about the health problems associated with coronavirus? In other words, do you see mental health challenges rising as much because people are losing their jobs and their livelihoods as because they're afraid of what could come from the coronavirus?
Well, I think, you know, there's now multiple streams of stress. So some people have secure jobs but have mental health vulnerability. Some people are experiencing a lot of turbulence in their economic life and are developing mental health problems that didn't have them before. So I think, you know, what you find is that every person is individual, but this is really one of a kind, as I like to say to people when they ask me, this is my first pandemic, as it is for you, Jeremy, right? And so the stress of loss of economic, the stress of what we call physical distancing, the uncertainties and unknown qualities of what's coming. Like, we actually don't know when this is going to end, and you don't know, and I don't know if somebody I love is going to develop this. So the chronic unsettling uncertainty is a reality. And for millions of Americans, unemployment is a risk. And there is some data that unemployment and economic distress correlates with mental health vulnerabilities, clinical depression, and the potential for an increased rate of suicide.
Do you think it's going to be difficult to convince lawmakers in Washington that this is a major issue that's probably going to develop very quickly, if it isn't already, in this country as we make our way collectively through the coronavirus pandemic and all the effects of it?
The lawmakers have been pretty open to the idea that teletherapy should be covered, that some people don't have a computer, so you should be able to use your flip phone. These are things that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services had not really considered before. What we're going to need is for them to show creativity as this becomes a more chronic phenomenon that we just have to learn to live with, because mental health is going to have a long tail. Every time I look at one of those virus charts, Jeremy, I think about the mental health post-traumatic impact of people who are losing loved ones, of healthcare workers who are getting psychologically traumatized, first responders who are, you know, exposed to, you know, a lot of bad outcomes. So I think the mental health piece is going to be with us for a long time. And I think that creative work will be needed on the policy side to think about best ways to deliver care to people.
What is the cost if we do not adequately address the nation's mental health right now?
It's pretty well established that untreated mental health conditions lead to not just suicide, which is, you know, of course, a huge problem, overdose, which of course are two things that you would think would be part of it, but it's bad for your heart to have an untreated depression. Your diabetes is more poorly controlled if you have untreated depression. If you have panic attacks, your ability to sustain your care and get chemotherapy for a cancer that might be treatable is limited. So I think there's a hidden cost that people will find in terms of their medical care. And then, of course, untreated mental health conditions make it harder to parent, harder to be in relationships, harder to contribute to your community. So I think that, you know, it's really important for us to take this moment where so many of us are feeling stress in mental health, or are poorly sleeping or having panic attacks, and realize that, you know, this is a common condition that many people live with, mental health problems, and that we need to treat them the same, and we need to, you know, eliminate the shame.
I want to ask you one more thing. I saw one of your ads on TV, and everybody in it was saying it's okay to not be okay. Tell me a little bit about what that means exactly. It's okay to not be okay.
In our society, we're socialized to say we're doing okay, we've got this covered. Your experience, whatever it is okay. So if you're an introvert and you're secretly enjoying some aspects of this, that's okay. But if you're a person who has having trouble accessing care for a recurrence of bipolar disorder and you need help, that's okay. Seek help. I find that messaging to be very loving and welcoming to the complexity of the human condition under stress. You know, it's okay not to be okay. Never worry alone. And, you know, reach out for help and, you know, you will find somebody.
That is Ken Duckworth, who is the Chief Medical Officer of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Dr. Duckworth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for taking up this important question.
Last month, Alaska's biggest rural airline carrier, Raven Air Group, declared bankruptcy as passenger demand fell. This placed tens of thousands of rural Alaskans in jeopardy should they need transportation to bigger cities for help. The airline blames its demise on travel restrictions that many villages have put in place to protect themselves from the coronavirus. Christy Schallenberger of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Christina McDonough is a law student in New York right now, but she's been keeping up with news from her home state of Alaska. McDonough is Subiak, one of the Alaska Native people that live in southwest Alaska. She grew up in the village of Perryville, and she remembers breaking her arm as a kid.
And I had to wait several days for the airplane to come to take me to the nearest hub, which was Dillingham. And, you know, a broken arm is nothing compared to pneumonia.
She's worried the state isn't prepared for a coronavirus outbreak in rural Alaska. Reliable medical transport is one of her biggest concerns. Raven Air Group served more than 100 predominantly Alaska Native villages, and without much warning, the rural airline declared bankruptcy in April and abruptly left villages without mail delivery or passenger transportation. That left a lot of questions for rural healthcare providers who depend on those airlines to fly patients in for medical care. Heidi Hedberg directs the Division of Public Health at the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
We are hoping and waiting to see the private industry step into that vacuum and meet the needs of the villages that have had reduced flight services into their communities.
But Alaska Native communities still remember the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, wiping out entire communities. So nearly all the villages in southwest Alaska put strict policies in place, prohibiting anyone from outside the village from coming in order to protect themselves against the virus. Hedberg says the State Emergency Center is working with the rural airlines that are left to properly transport rural patients who test positive for coronavirus who need urgent care. But should the airline refuse or is unavailable,
that's when the National Guard or the Coast Guard is able to be used to transport that positive case.
But that's not the case with non-coronavirus patients. With no regular air service, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, one of the few rural health providers in southwest Alaska, has had to turn to charter flights to get non-coronavirus patients to Bethel, a small town that serves as one of the region's hubs. That's expensive, says Mitchell Forbes of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, costing them $1,000 per flight.
Right now, we've continued to tell the state that if a solution is not found there, it is not financially feasible for us to continue to carry that cost.
But Forbes says they will make sure they won't leave anyone behind in a village that needs medical help. For Here and Now, I'm Christy Schallenberger.
The number of Americans filing jobless claims last week grew to just shy of 3 million, bringing the total since the pandemic began to nearly 37 million. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, we should note this is the sixth week in a row that these jobless claims have come down after peaking March 28th. But that said, we're still talking about 20% of the American workforce filing for unemployment. Are you alarmed or optimistic about today's numbers?
Look, I think they are, you know, the first headline is that they're cause for alarm. These are huge numbers, and they're abating very slowly. The two pieces of good news are that some of it will be temporary, right? Some of it is a result of shutdowns, and we don't know when those shutdowns end. That's a political discussion. But when they do, some proportion of these people will go back to work. The other thing to be optimistic about is that the Federal Reserve Chair has said this is really, really serious and more needs to be done. Now, that does stand in contrast with what the president, what Mitch McConnell are saying. They're not sure that we need another round of stimulus at the moment. The Democrats are looking for another $3 trillion deal. But the fact is, people who know about these things are saying this isn't going to get better on its own. The government's going to have to continue to think about creative new ways to fix it. So I'm both pessimistic and optimistic at the same time.
Well, when you talk about the Democrats' $3 trillion relief package plan, and again, it doesn't have bipartisan support, at least not yet, this one would put a lot more aid into state and local governments, right?
Yeah, because think about this. With all of these people unemployed, they're not paying taxes in many cases. They're not earning and paying taxes to their state and local governments. State and local governments, unlike the federal government, can't, generally speaking, go into deficit. They can't go into debt. They can raise bonds if they're, you know, building a dam or a bridge or something like that. But they, generally speaking, can't spend more money than they have. So then you start seeing services cut on a local level, including policing, ambulances, health centers, things like that. So the states have long said that they haven't received enough money, probably a third of what they need, generally speaking. And small businesses haven't received enough money. So only the federal government has the heft and the power to create a stimulus plan that's big enough to affect everybody. So that conversation doesn't have bipartisan support, but it is being had.
Well, and when you hear Republicans talk about it, and we just talked today with Senator Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, who is concerned about how much money is being spent on this, and we hear about trillion-dollar deficits, multi-trillion-dollar deficits, Is there good reason to be concerned about that?
Yeah, I think there is. I think that we often don't spend enough time talking about debt and deficit. I would say this isn't exactly the moment to make this the priority, right? There are reasons to get into debt from a federal government perspective, and this would be one of them. So I think we have to think of debt more holistically. I think Senator Lankford's right. I think a lot of people who are concerned about debt are right, that it's a conversation we should have more frequently, whether it comes to government debt, corporate debt, or household debt. But emergencies are generally not the ideal time to be deciding to tighten the belt.
Well, and the argument would be that it's going to be a lot cheaper to spend the money now than it will after millions and millions more jobs are lost, and some maybe permanently.
Correct. Yeah.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
The killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia received little attention in February. Later, after a video circulated, it became big news, fueling protests across the nation. Here's Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms earlier this week speaking about the case.
It's heartbreaking. It's 2020, and this was a lynching of an African-American man.
Two white men are now charged with murder, and social justice activists are now assessing how to mobilize while adhering to the constraints imposed during this pandemic. Opal Tometi is co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and she's been thinking a lot about this and the role of BLM 7 years after its inception. Opal joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Opal, you know, Ahmaud Arbery's death in the minds of many is, of course, reminiscent of Trayvon Martin's death and so many other cases over the years. I can imagine it's the same for you.
Yeah, it is extremely saddening to see that even in this moment where so many of us are grappling with the pandemic, we are still seeing these types of horrific cases where unarmed Black people are being targeted and killed. And sadly, Ahmaud, the story here is just too familiar to us.
Yeah. You launched the initial social media and website for Black Lives Matter back in 2013. In some ways, it was reimagining digital activism because it was so new back then and was really one of the major ways this movement got going. In the years since, people have been questioning whether this online activism translates to change. I'm just wondering from you, 7 years later, and now with COVID-19 changing how really activists can gather physically, what do you see as the role of Black Lives Matter?
You know, it was so important for us to start utilizing social media because we knew that we needed spaces that we could be unapologetic about who we are, about what our concerns were. And so true to previous social movements, you know, the civil rights movement and beyond, we are making use of whatever the tools are at our disposal for the given time. And so it's not too dissimilar from what maybe a Dr. Martin Luther King would have done with the newspaper or television and beyond. So we're just using the means that we have for our time to make similar concerns to those of our ancestors known.
But building upon that, you know, along with those digital spaces, which have become even more important during the time of COVID-19, the ground mobilization that took place, particularly after Ferguson and the death of Michael Brown back in 2014, that in-person protest was super powerful. You know, we have no idea what the future holds for us, but have you been thinking about what the future of in-person protest might look like now with COVID-19 and this post-pandemic world that we expect to see? And also knowing that we've actually seen protests happening throughout the country where people are still gathering because they understand the power of being in person with each other, but they're taking all of those safety measures that health officials are telling us to do.
Nothing will ever replace human beings gathering together. And so much of what we did, even on the creation of Black Lives Matter, was using those new media tools to share with each other and to connect with each other, but it was so that we could mobilize in person. One of the things that I found so heartening in this time was, despite the fact that we're in the midst of this pandemic, we saw this amazing movement for justice for Ahmaud emerge, where people were running for Ahmaud. They were doing all that they could to elevate his name. We're also seeing similarly with the case of Breonna Taylor, the EMT who was killed in her home. People are beginning to say her name and uplift this really tragic and recent case that was only just a month ago. And people are saying, you know, enough is enough. Despite the pandemic, we won't be distracted. Yes, people are social distancing. They're wearing their masks. They're being very safe as they do it. And I think that's important. I think that's going to be some of what we see here in the future. And we're not going to stop gathering and demanding change.
One of the major issues that really is the issue of this moment is the disproportionate amount of Black lives that have suffered and people who have died from COVID-19. Is this something that Black Lives Matter, the movement, is addressing, the systemic inequalities that are the reasons that we may be seeing this disproportionate amount of Black death?
Yeah, what I'm seeing come out from this large racial justice movement is that there are many different groups highlighting the fact that this isn't, you know, just happenstance or because we're negligent or doing something wrong, but we do have systemic issues in this society that allows for Black people to be impacted in this very acute way. And it's really disturbing. I know people who have passed away as a result of this virus. And it's something that I think we could have predicted. But to see it firsthand, it's been very, very difficult. But yes, our movements are definitely speaking up about this, are doing all that we can, from mobilizing online to getting together in person to organizing mutual aid and just being very creative about how we show up for one another.
Something that I've always wondered about, you know, a few years ago, the Black Lives Matter movement was listed as a terrorist organization. And this kind of labeling is not new in our nation's history. How have you navigated this?
It's been so disturbing to see how Black organizers and people who have the right, and we know we have the right, to speak out and to name injustice in our community and assert our dignity, that we're being mislabeled, that our message is being manipulated and misconstrued on purpose for an agenda that is rooted in white supremacy and racism. And we know that this has happened to many human rights leaders before us, from, you know, you have your Martin Luther King, you have your Rosa Parks, you have various leaders over the years who their actions have been maligned, right? And they weren't necessarily the most popular people in their generation, but history proves them right. And they knew that they were right, and they had the moral high ground. And it's been disturbing to see that, you know, even decades later, the lessons of those times haven't really been applied and haven't really been learned. And we're seeing the same type of malignment of our movements as well. And it puts us in danger. When we are the ones who are trying to, you know, make peace, they target us, they troll us, they try to put our private information online. And we have to take our own precautions to ensure our safety in this time and beyond.
What's next for you and Black Lives Matter and the role that it's currently playing? What are activists asking for as we deal with several major issues in our country?
What I see as what's next for our social movements is that we continue to grow, that they continue to feel safe joining organizations. It doesn't even have to be the formal network that we have, but there are many different groups across the country that are doing such phenomenal work, and we think it's important that at the local level, people get involved. We have an opportunity right now to transform the way things are done, and we've seen some wins over the years, and we need to see a fundamental transformation of our democracy. And so there are 351 people who have been fatally shot by police just this year And that's, you know, despite this pandemic. And it's not just about the police brutality. And I think that's what people also are getting. They understand that issues of racism cut across all the spheres of our lives, including the healthcare sector, as we're seeing. And so I'm encouraging people just to continue to pay attention and to make sure that their voices and their concerns are known. And I think even as the elections are coming up, we have an opportunity to mobilize and encourage folks to get out the vote. And we're going to need us. We need all of us to show up and transform our nation.
That's Opal Tometi. She's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Opal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It would be almost time for summer camp for many kids, but camp directors around the country are wondering if it's safe enough to welcome visitors this year, which brings us to New Hampshire. Some historians believe the first summer camp actually started in the state back in 1880. As for this year, well, here's New Hampshire Public Radio's Lauren Chulgin.
Adriana Ben says she grew up faster than most 15-year-olds. She says it's because she lives in Manhattan. Her mom calls it a fast life. Adriana's friends all have credit cards. They take Ubers to fancy sushi restaurants at 15.
I feel like living in New York, I have to keep up with everyone. And I don't really like it. Everyone's so mature. They act like they're like in their 20s at like a frat party or something.
But when she was 10 years old, she found a place where she could escape all that pressure. An innocent place, she calls it, where the only thing she's stressed about is who is going to win color wars. It's Camp Bernadette in Wolfboro, New Hampshire.
At camp, it's like chill. Everyone's going at their own pace, living their own life. And I don't need to like be worried or anything. It's really fun.
But for weeks now, instead of counting the days until her trip up north, she's been trying to mentally prepare herself for the possibility that camp could be canceled. Because the things she loves most could now be considered dangerous, like bunking with girls from all over the world.
You get to like experience how they live and like trade snacks with them. But that's definitely worrisome because you don't know anyone can be carrying the virus. So like, it's kind of scary.
New Hampshire camp directors know there are a lot of kids who feel just like this. They don't want camp to get canceled either. But how do they pull it off safely in this environment?
You're shooting basketball. We can't both touch the same basketball.
Ryan Holder is program director at Adventure Lore in Danville. Their summer camp programs are adventure-based, but they also offer counseling. They often serve kids with depression, anxiety, ADHD.
Yesterday I was doing archery. It's like, okay, we're shooting to the same target. Okay, you go grab your arrows, only touch yours, and then I'll go and only touch mine. And then I'll sanitize them when we're all done. Like, that's just how you have to do it right now. But imagine running a summer camp, like a big summer camp for like 250 kids like that.
A few camps in New Hampshire have already made the tough call that no, they can't imagine that. There's no one-size-fits-all solution here. There are around 160 licensed summer camps in New Hampshire, and no two of them are the same. And this doesn't include town rec programs or sports camps. These are overnight camps or day camps. Some are for kids with special needs. Some are run by national organizations. Others are independent. And so each camp has to make its own decision. And to do that, they're all waiting on local and national guidelines.
If everybody's got to wear masks, then we're not going to run camp.
This is Garrett Colgan-Snyder. He's the owner and director of Camp Hawkeye in Moultonboro.
The kids as young as 7, you know, most of the basic masks that you have aren't designed to be run around with and get sweaty. You know, they're not designed to go into the water. We don't want to give a false sense of safety.
But until those guidelines come down, camps who haven't closed yet exist in this weird space where they have to act and prepare like camp is still happening until it isn't. Colgan-Snyder says this has been the hardest thing. It's a lot of work. You're essentially running a small village. Staff needs to be trained. Ropes courses need to be inspected. And meanwhile, camp staff are trying not to overpromise, but still keep hope alive, reminding kids that their special place will always be there for them, even if it's not this year.
Yeah, I think it's about holding on to a hope of normalcy.
John Tilley is executive director of YMCA Camp Coniston in Grantham, which just announced that they won't be opening this summer. But they're one of many camps who have tried to connect with their kids by putting beloved traditions online. There are now digital campfires and Zoom sing-alongs. Now, the irony of this is not lost on Tilley. Camp is intentionally a very no-screens environment. But Tilley says they've been streaming Vespers every Thursday night, a pre-dinner tradition where staff tell inspirational stories. And campers have loved it.
It's absolutely magnificent how many people feel the need to sort of join back into these rituals that ground them and tie them to sort of each other. And we need connections now more than we ever did before.
Once camps decide if they're on, the next big decision will fall to camp families. Back on the Upper East Side, Adriana's mom, Layla, says she keeps thinking back to the beginning of the pandemic, the sounds of sirens and helicopters every night. She really wants to get Adriana out of the city.
I'm worried for her to just have to have spent many, many months in a tiny apartment, and she hasn't seen any friends in months. I feel like we might risk it.
Layla says it feels like she's choosing between Adriana's physical health and mental health. And she says it's a horrible gamble to take. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Chooljian.
Well, every time I look at the weather forecast and see that it's going to be cold and rainy, I think, well, maybe it's just a bad forecast. And maybe I'm right, because meteorologists are reporting a shortfall in weather data normally gathered by commercial aircraft. With more than two-thirds of the world's passenger jets grounded during the coronavirus pandemic, weather forecasting agencies are missing out on measurements of wind speed, air pressure, and temperature, typically collected by sensors mounted on the noses of many commercial planes. Last week, the United Nations warned that the decline of meteorological measurements from airplanes was as high as 80% and up to 90% in the tropics and the southern hemisphere. That's not just making it harder to count on your local forecast. It could also complicate predictions for the Atlantic hurricane season, which starts June 1st. In the meantime, when I see that there's a chance of rain for 5 of the next 7 days, I'll just assume it's a data error and hope for the best. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.